Hello, good day, and welcome back to Farewell, listeners. You are hearing the voice of Clay Skipper. I'm joined by Brad Stahlberg and Steve Magnus. Today, we are going to be talking about losing. I want to talk about losing for two reasons. One is March Madness is about to be over, but has just been dominating the last two, 3 weeks as of this recording. We're recording the Monday of the championship game between UConn and Purdue. So last night, South Carolina won the championship over Iowa in the women's tournament. And obviously, we talk a lot about winning and celebrating winners, as we should. But most people lose. You can only have one winner in the tournament. And so I think it's worth discussing how to lose well. And I want to get both of your opinions on that. And then also, we've gotten a lot of voicemails, a handful of voicemails from people talking about a different kind of loss, which is losing the ability that they once had as an athlete or a performer, and sort of how to cope with that, whether they've had injury, whether they just had usual run-of-the-mill aging. I think both of these, they're obviously different types of loss, but they both deal with losing and losing well and losing gracefully, and sort of, so I think they can be lumped into one bucket. But what I would start with is, Steve, you obviously were a great runner on your own. You were a running coach. I'm curious how you thought about, or how you think about, losing well, what you learned from your own personal experience, and how you coached other people on how to lose well.
Sure. How long we got, Clay? I could talk about this all day. This is coaching 101. To keep it simple, I think a lot of our ideas around winning and losing in the popular culture, especially popular coaching, are wrong. And that's because if we think about it, right, if we think about competing, we think, oh, we've got to care a lot. Like, you know, you've got to feel the loss. There's all sorts of examples from football. I'm remembering a couple of years ago, one of the Texas coaches, Bo Davis, got caught on camera after they lost a big game. And he gave this tirade on like the athletes joking and laughing afterwards. And he was like, you know, essentially F-bombs everywhere, but saying like, you got to care, like you guys don't got care. Like after this loss, you should just feel it and suffer and like all that stuff. And I think that often backfires. So if we look at competition, I guess to set the stage, what is it? You know, in many ways, if we look at competition, it's a game of status, right? And if we look at the research on status, there's three ways to accumulate status, which is one is dominance, which is traditionally how we see competition, win or lose, right? Do you dominate? Do you not? That's where we typically see it. But there's two other ways to keep status. Competence, which we talk a lot about in the growth equation. Am I myself getting better? And then the third way, which we don't talk about as much, is virtue, which means essentially, am I doing good with other people, right? It doesn't take the outcome necessarily into account. And I think when we talk about losing, most of the time we talk about that dominant side. Like I lost, my status gets hurt. This is why I feel threatened. This is why I feel like defensive often. And if I stay in that, it backfires. The other thing that I'll throw out there, that's a little psychology. The other thing that I think really important to set the stage, and then I'll tell you what I did as a coach, is what happens biologically. So when we have that loss, and particularly if it hits our status, and that dominant side, cortisol goes up, testosterone goes down. Now, this is important because a couple things that we know from research. The desire to compete again, to get up and compete again and put that loss behind you, correlates and is related to that hormonal balance. So if cortisol goes up and testosterone goes down, my desire to compete again, to try again, to persist goes down as well. But it turns out, again, so lots of psychology research, we don't have to lose and have that traditional cortisol goes up, testosterone goes down. We can maintain our testosterone levels. We cannot experience as high cortisol levels or stress levels. How? Well, we get out of that threat and protect mode, and we don't have it attack our status as much. Brad and I have written about this, talked about this a lot, but if it doesn't attack who you are, where you see that loss is more like informational instead of personal, where you don't stew in the thing, you don't have that kind of negative biological thing. All right, so keep that all in mind. I know I threw a lot at you. From a coaching standpoint, if someone loses, what do I do? It's essentially four things. Number one is get out of threat and protect mode. Get out of that high cortisol, low testosterone. How do you do that? You shoot the shit with your friends. You socialize. You deal with the thing. You send your athletes in track and field. You say, they come over to you as a coach pissed off and you say, hey, go cool down with all your teammates and then come back 15, 20 minutes later and we'll talk. That often gets them out of that kind of stress mode. And then when you're dealing with the thing, you keep it informational, not personal. Third thing that I do is build themselves up, like remind them that their status hasn't taken a hit. Remind them that this one race doesn't find them, that they have other things in the world. You broaden their perspective. And then I think the last part that is really important is what I'd call like reframing and learning from it. So how we frame a loss, how we interpret it, matters a lot in terms of how it impacts our psychology and, you know, where we go in the future. If we frame it as this devastating thing, this thing that just like hits us personally, then all that does in the future, and we have research on this, is the next game, your brain predicts, it's like, oh shit, we're going into the arena where we might like get hit with this personal I am failure thing. And then it just like, it compounds, you feel more stress, you feel more anxiety. It puts you in a worse place to perform. So I think it's really important, like once you've got out of that stress protect mode, is to kind of frame it appropriately. And sometimes this is like hours after, sometimes this is the next day, but you've got to do the framing or else it kind of can ingrain in a negative light.
That's really interesting. And the thing that jumps out to me at that last point is, in addition to framing it in the moment, there's also this longer term trajectory where you don't know what the loss is going to mean in the longer term, right? And so you can feel very zoomed in when you lose something. Obviously, it hurts in the acute moment, but on a longer time scale, that thing might be what, you know, you hear so often these redemption stories of teams who make all the finals and lose and they come back and win the next year. And so that loss in that moment when they lose, obviously it's hard and difficult and painful, but then it's kind of the thing that gets them, maybe this is just narrative storytelling, but it's often said it's the thing that gets them back next year. So when they win next year, it's almost like that loss wasn't actually a loss. It was part of the larger win. And so I think on a longer time scale, if you can zoom out, it's that idea of like, you don't know what this loss is going to mean on a longer time horizon.
You know, Clay, there's so much research both in sport and then actually outside of sport and dealing with difficult challenges outside of sport, that essentially as the conclusion is that if you have what narrative psychologists call growth themes in that framing, you tend to adapt pretty well. You bounce back, you grow from it, you learn from it. If you don't have those growth themes, meaning like you don't see the future, you don't see the hope of it, you don't see how this kind of fits into the narrative that allows you to propel and go forward, often you get that kind of negative ingraining of like, hey, this is something that's going to kind of scar me. So like how you process and frame the loss, I think you put it perfectly on. A lot of times your job as a coach is often to zoom out when everything is telling you to zoom in. And I think that's where, again, as coaches, we often get it wrong because we tell people like, zoom in more, like, you know, you should feel horrible because this should hurt. And yeah, you might feel horrible. That means you care. I get that. But like, if we linger in that spot, all our brain kind of learns is like, you know, ingrain this negative feeling, almost create like a phobia around competing because like that's what your brain's going to latch onto.
I want to get to you, Brad, but I have one quick follow-up for you, Steve, which I think is interesting is like, cause you brought up the idea of like how people often say you should be so upset after a loss, right? And you see this a lot in pop culture when an NFL player losing the playoffs and then he's seen at the club and Twitter, and I know Twitter's not necessarily real life, but people are like, why is he out celebrating? He should be miserable. As a coach, how do you think? Like, would you have cared if you saw some of your runners after getting thrashed at a meet or something joking? Like, how do you think about that? Because that's something that's often in the discourse and the culture is like, we do expect our athletes to be severely pained, like Draymond Green or something, and be enraged at a loss. But maybe that's sort of erroneous in a way.
It's completely wrong. I want them to be joking. I want them to go eat dinner together, laugh. You know, depending on the time of the season, I may even want them to go out to the club and have a good time. Not all the time, right? Depends on their recovery and sleep and all that stuff. But I want them to have fun. And that's why often, you know, as a coach, like if we had a particularly crappy meet, man, I would take them to go get, you know, desserts or frozen yogurt or like, you know, go bowl or whatever have you after, something to get us out of that mindset. Because we know this, like, and I'm going to simplify the biology a little bit here, but like the longer we let ourselves stew in like that kind of cortisol stress state, the more our brain kind of goes like, oh, okay, like this is what we're supposed to experience and live in. And cortisol isn't bad, but it's meant to kind of like make us, you know, be aware that things suck and then get us out of there, right? To escape, to find something better to do. So I think the fan version or the old school coach version of like, you know, I want you to feel it and stew in it and like, you know, be miserable. Like to me, that's naturally going to be the reaction for most people because they're competitors. You know, there's a reason they're playing the game. And I don't need to contribute to that. My job is to get them out of that so we can be in a more productive state, both for our recovery and a more productive state for our psychology. Because if we look at it again, when we sit in that stewed stress state, we narrow. We're not even able to evaluate the game. You know, there were some great studies on rugby players that in that kind of stress state, they either showed them like what they did well or where they screwed up afterwards. And if they showed them what they screwed up with, again, after that tough loss, cortisol levels went up. And then the next game performance, which was, you know, days later, they performed worse, right? Because they're in that sensitive window of like, the negative stuff attacks me, it beats me down. I want to get them out of that as quickly as possible.
I like that you said that I consider, I think that's really interesting how you say, I consider my job to get them out of that. Cause I think that sounds obviously healthier and more backed by research, but I do think that's not always the narrative in our culture. Brad, what are your thoughts on this? And then I'm also curious, Brad, like to get, I know you coach like your son a lot and you coach young kids, and obviously winning and losing is very different for 6-year-olds than it is for people competing in professional sports. But I'm curious if there's anything to be learned from how you talk to them about loss.
All right. Well, I'll start more broadly, which is to echo everything that Steve said with maybe three caveats. The first is, I think that the importance of curiosity is just enormous here. And what I mean by that is, if you can be curious about your journey, your path, and whatever it is that you're doing, it's very hard to spiral into despair and be curious at the same time. So after a really challenging loss, if you can be curious about, well, why am I feeling this heartbreak? What could I have done differently? What does this mean for the future? Like asking questions just helps take you out of that immediate default spiral into rage, despair, anger. And there's some really interesting affective neuroscience that essentially shows, like, you cannot be curious and panicked or angry at the same time. It's a zero-sum game. So trying to bring as much curiosity into what you're feeling as possible is very helpful. I think community is the most helpful, far more than even curiosity. In both your examples, Steve mentioned take them out to frozen yogurt. He didn't say have the person go alone to frozen yogurt. You said going to the club together. There's just something about being amongst others that have walked the same path that also care deeply that really just helps to hold the hurt and in almost like a lets it dissipate a little bit into the community. So finding someone else to go through that with, I think really makes it easier. And then the third thing that I'll say is it obviously depends on the loss. A regular season loss is different than a playoff loss. A championship loss for a senior that is going to go play at the next level is different than a championship loss for a senior whose career is over. And I think that when there's a lot of sadness and heartbreak, which as Steve said, is the default response for most people, there's that saying that time heals all wounds. And I really think it's true. And I think there, the job of a good coach or leader or manager or parent is not to minimize what that person's feeling, to support them, but also to let them know that, like, if they just, you know, keep showing up, they'll learn something, they'll make meaning from this, and they'll grow. Those are like for the massive losses. You know, that's like the last playoff game of your high school senior year when you're not playing college. Most adults don't face losses like that anymore in our careers, whether you're a pro athlete or a pro attorney, like you generally get another shot. And there it's something that Steve and I have talked about, you know, ad infinitum, which is just like, get back on the bandwagon and get back to the work again. Like it's really, really hard to be feeling despair and heartbreak at the same time you're doing something that's interesting. I mean, the best thing for me after a piece that I really care deeply about flops is to start working on the next one. Not to think about it flopping. I mean, you do what you can on the internet to try to support it and get it going. But at a certain point, it's clear, like, this just isn't going to get going. It's just start writing the next one. Because again, like, it's very hard to be doing the thing and then wallowing in despair at the same time. So curiosity, which I think is part and parcel of what Steve said, like growth, right? If the ultimate goal of this is to learn something about yourself and to grow as a person or to grow as a unit, then being really curious about everything that happens is good, winning or losing. Community and helping to deflate some of those hard feelings in a group. And then being patient with yourself, allowing yourself to feel that heartbreak, and then trying to get back to the work itself. To your second question about coaching six-year-olds, I actually think it is hugely important because the skills and habits and mindsets that a six-year-old learns, it's like a very neuroplastic time in their life. This stuff's going to stick with them. And there is just so much default pressure that I've seen for kids at that age to want to succeed and want to do well, that you get incredible opportunities to coach this. So just last week in a baseball practice, Theo, my son, it's coach pitch. And a couple of the other kids before him hit the ball and Theo just didn't hit it. And it's practice. The coach probably threw him like 9 pitches and I'm the assistant coach. So I'm back there catching, just encouraging. And then at some point, like, we got to cut it off and get the other kid up to bat. And Theo just walks over to the dugout, turns to me, and just starts bawling. Just like full on sad tears. And I go over to him and I give him a hug and I say, Theo, like, you seem to be feeling really sad. What's going on? He said, Dad, I didn't hit it. I didn't get a turn to hit it. Everyone else hit it. I didn't hit it. And in that moment, I'm like, this is the most important moment of the practice, maybe the most important moment of the season. And essentially what I told him is that it's really hard not to hit it when you really want to hit it. And Dad played baseball too. And Dad got really sad when he didn't hit it. And Dad was a pretty good baseball player. And guess what, Theo? I didn't hit it more times than I did. And part of playing the game is sometimes you're not going to hit it. And then calmed him down a little. And I said, you know, would it be fun if every time you went up there, you knew you were going to hit it? Or would it be boring? He's like, well, I guess it'd be kind of boring. Yeah. So part of what makes baseball fun is you don't know if you're going to hit it. And guess what, Theo? You know how you're feeling when you struck out? Your teammates are going to feel the same way when they strike out. So it's really important to cheer for them and to always cheer for each other. And that was it. And I think that, you know, my hope is that I'll get many moments like that this season. And the same thing for when he crushes the ball, to remind him that, hey, feel really good and savor it because you might strike out next time. Those moments go a real, real long way. And I think just like reminding them that winning and losing is a part of the game. And I wouldn't use this language because it's not age appropriate, but like the ultimate point of the game is growth. I mean, this comes back to a phenomenal book by James Carse, Finite and Infinite Games. I'm pretty sure we've talked about it on the podcast before, which essentially says that we all throughout our lives play two kinds of games. There are finite games where there is a start and an end and a winner and a loser. And then there is an infinite game where the goal is just to keep playing. Striking out or getting a hit is a finite game. Winning the Little League World Series is a finite game. Even winning a freaking Super Bowl is a finite game. The infinite game is experiencing growth as a person. And we just want to hold on to that perspective that it's ultimately the infinite game that really matters, while allowing ourselves to be absolutely gutted and heartbroken if we lose at a finite game that really matters to us. Like, both those things can be true. And anyone who says the outcomes don't matter, it's all about internal growth, has never like achieved anything at a high level and doesn't acknowledge that often it's our livelihood that results from these wins or losses. So two things can be true at once. Like, the finite losses can sting like a bitch, and what really matters is the infinite game. And then coming back to what I said early, what helps us play the infinite game is curiosity, community, and coming back to the thing.
Yeah, I like that, the infinite, finite, infinite game framework, because it is really hard to do. And I appreciate what you said about people saying that winning, you know, if people say winning doesn't matter, they haven't achieved much, because it does matter in an acute sense. But I think if you can keep that mindset of everything we do is curriculum, and the sort of general school we're at is life. I know that's kind of corny, but like, then the losses become an opportunity to work on frustration and loss in a way that I think is really helpful as you try to just like become a better person, I think. The other thing that jumps out to me is, I like that you said, I think you said that you teach Theo, or you would teach Theo, to approach wins the same way. That reminds me of a coaching cliche that is a cliche, but is a cliche for a reason, which is never get too high, never get too low. And just the idea that like you approach a win in the same way you do a loss. And again, you train that muscle to just like let it go, so that you're not basking in the glory, but you're also not wallowing in regret. And you can just, if you work that muscle every time you have a victory, every time you have a loss, it makes it easier next time a loss or win comes around.
Yeah. It's the most important attribute for a cornerback in football is a short memory.
Yeah. Or a like pitcher.
Or a pitcher. Yeah. But like, you know, I mean, it's really for anyone, but I'd say it's true for most of us. Because like, whether or not you get beat on a post you don't want to take that into the next play. Whether or not you got the promotion or not, you don't want to take it into the next cycle. Whether or not your book made the bestseller list, you don't want to be harping on that as you sit down to write the next book. Those things can sting. They might be there 5-10%, but you got to try to like make actually playing the game and being present for what's in front of you the other 90%+.
And this is why you see really good athletes often have some sort of process where they're able to either review and take forward or let go and move on. And I actually think, you know, intern Nate is a great example, because his event, the decathlon, is there's 10 separate events. And whatever happened in the last one, like, you got to put it behind you and then focus on the next. And it's like the ultimate mental game. And this is why I often loved watching field events or athletes in the decathlon in track and field, because like, they are all masters at having some sort of process. It's the, you know, what Damian Warner told you on the podcast, you know, it's like having a different pair of shoes. Once you get in the different spikes, like, this is who I am now. There's a wonderful example of a world-class high jumper who has this process where she just like writes down, you know, make or miss. She writes down, okay, what's the one thing I want to learn from this? And then what's the thing I'm focusing on the next jump so that I can put it behind me and move on? And you don't have to be as concrete in that, but you have to. I mean, I remember in running, like, it's not like you have a break to do this, but within the race, especially in the longer races, like, when something bad happens, you either get stuck on it, linger and ruminate, or you figure out how to be like, okay, that was a crappy mile, or I got dropped and now I'm in the second pack. Great. Do I wallow in it, or do I put this behind and figure out how to move forward? And I think that's one of the best things that sport can teach us. But I think what you find is that the greats have some sort of way to process that, even if it's quickly process it. And I think the other thing that both research and elite athletes tell us is that avoiding the thing doesn't help. Meaning, if we cope with the thing by just like avoiding the hurt or avoiding whatever it feels like, That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about cope with it and deal with it in a productive manner so you can get to a better place. And that's a form of like approaching the thing. And I think if you just kind of put it off to the side, avoid the feelings, avoid the negative thing, like I'll deal with it later, that also kind of backfires in the long run as well.
How do you guys think about using a loss as fuel for the future? So you hear this a lot in sport, right? Like we got knocked out of the playoffs last year and that became our fuel to win a championship. In our world, it might be, you know, you didn't hit the New York Times bestseller list. So now you're still hungry for it. For an attorney, it might be you lost a big case and you're going to win the next one. Do you guys buy into that? Or do you think that's just like post hoc narrative bending to have an easier time dealing with failure?
I think it's real. I mean, the thing that jumps out to me is it's real, but it's not easy, right? Like, I mean, the thing that jumps out to me when I'm thinking like, okay, what are the losses? And I don't know why this jumped out to me, but I think about like bad interviews I've done. And then I sit there after an interview, and I'm like, why did that go poorly? And I beat myself up. I ruminate like, oh, that was, why did I ask that question? Why didn't I articulate that better? Why did I start here when I should have started there to open the person up more? And I can wallow in that, but then I'm like, all right, great, use that. Like now you know this. Next time you go in an interview, that is like, that's feedback. And that is helpful. It reminds me of like when a comedian does stand up and they bomb. It's like they're testing out their material. That is a loss, but recognizing it as a loss and being like, what can I take from this is then really useful to bring into the next thing.
What about a competitive loss would be my next question. Because like, and what I mean by that, Clay, is so there are so many things within your control, but yeah. Steve, what about an athlete shows up and just runs their best freaking race and they're just outdone. And then that athlete like starts to feel hopeless because they're like, I'm never going to be as good as these other guys or gals.
Yeah. I mean, I think this comes down to the nuance and I think the framing of it. So I think Clay's right. Even on a competitive aspect, like, can you use it as fuel? Absolutely. But it can be a productive fuel or a destructive fuel. And it can be hopeful or, as you just pointed out, hopeless, right? So I think we've got to see where it frames. And to give you an idea, you know, you gave the hopeful versus hopeless one. Maybe you get smacked in the face after you ran, you know, your personal best or your best race and you say, oh, there's no hope, blah, blah, blah. In those situations, I think the job as a coach is to find ways to give hope, right? It's like, you know, that's when you pull out the old adages of like, you know, you're only doing 60 miles a week, they're doing 80 miles a week. We still got room to grow and things like that. You just pull out of your pocket or they're peaked and tapered. Like we're worried about this meet later on. The old, you haven't done speed work yet excuse. And in a lot of ways it is excuse, but you can use it as like a framing device to give someone hope. So there's reasons that coaches say those things. I think on the productive versus destructive, the way I see it is you can either use that fuel as like a little bit of motivation that can get you the little umph, or you can use that fuel that puts you so focused on like beating this individual or beating this person that you lose sight of the perspective or what you're trying to do. So the running example is simple. You know, someone maybe beats you for the state championship and then the, you know, next whatever months you spend training, thinking about this guy, this guy, this guy. And then you're focused on this guy. And then some other random dude has a different strategy and surprises you and takes you because like you're focused on them. Or you're, and I think the same could apply for team sports, depending on the context. So I think it just kind of depends, you know, as a coach, I used some of those strategies sometimes, like, again, it's individual, but you know, I'd say, hey, you know, remember last year when, you know, this guy out kicked you in the final 100 and how that felt? Like, go kick his ass. Why? Because like, again, the psychology tells us that rivalry games, or even there was this study that I came across the other day that showed that players, not all, but in general, play better when they're competing against the team that let them go in professional sports, right? Why? You have a little chip on your shoulder. So I think you can use that. But if you let that chip get too big and maybe push you from like productive to maybe like way too aggressive or anger and outrage, which maybe causes you to foul them more and like screw up the team tactics, then I think it can be destructive.
I also think it's worth saying that it's a good reminder in that luck plays such a huge role, right? Like maybe less so in sports, like in track, you know, it's pretty objective. You're either the fastest person or you're not. I think in team sports, it gets a little more complicated because there is a lot of luck with injuries and it's more of a complex operation. But I think it's a good reminder that like we like to imagine we are in control and we are in control of winning and losing. And I think this is, you know, maybe you do go out and have your best performance, but some other guy comes out that day and has a better performance. That's just like bad luck. And I think for most people listening to this, who are probably not Olympic sprinters, though shout out to our Olympic sprinter listeners, their losses are going to be, and wins are going to be very determined by luck. I mean, you brought up the New York Times bestseller. Like that is, I'm sure, like the best books sometimes get to the top, but a lot of times they don't. And it's just like, how well do you market it? How well can you get pre-sales? And, you know, so a lot of this is a crapshoot. And that's also a good reminder. Like, again, don't get too high. Don't get too low. When you win, you should take credit for the part that you've credited in, but recognize that you probably had a good opportunity. And when you lose, take the feedback, use it to grow, but also recognize like maybe that was just a bad day.
Yeah. When you were talking about that, Clay, I actually, I didn't think about the New York Times list, our own example, probably because it's too close to home. But I thought about like being a surgeon and having someone on the table. And there are times when you can do everything right and the outcome still doesn't go the way that you want, or just like pure luck, that person's blood pressure on the day, or that person's anatomy, or the timing of the surgery and that person's disease progression, and how hard that must be. And I know this because I've got surgeons that I've worked with and so on and so forth, like how hard it can be to not internalize that as something that you did and then to stay curious and to come back from that without, and this is very unique to surgeons, without like becoming a sociopath and completely losing your connection to humanity. So yeah, there are like truly life and death situations where luck plays a role. And then for the people that aren't Olympic sprinters or surgeons, yeah, there's the New York Times bestseller list. There's, did you get the award in your community? Did you win the clubhouse golf tournament? Did you win the promotion in your fiercely competitive company where everyone else wants it? And so much of that is luck in timing, in all sorts of things that are beyond our control, which again is why it's so important to try to take an infinite game approach to hold those finite games. Because if you're just playing the finite game and you do anything for long enough, you're going to be gutted like quite frequently for long periods of time. And generally you don't perform your best or find joy from a place of being gutted. But if you can hold the finite games in an infinite game, yeah, you'll be gutted, but that guttedness will be held in a container and it might only last a day or a week or a month, not an entire year.
And I think this gets to the point where it's so nuanced. And this is why I think it comes back to on the coaching side, like what I was doing is literally from the time of the race to whenever that athlete was going to walk up to me, I was analyzing in my head, okay, what is the thing that I should say to them now? Or should I just like punt it a little bit and say, go cool down so I can figure out how to handle this? Because there's nuance here in sports psychology. You know, they call it externalizing or internalizing failure. Externalizing, you blame it, hey, luck, weather, like all that stuff. Internalizing, it was me, effort, I didn't do this thing. And both can be good and bad, right? Because if we always externalize and we say, oh, it's always the luck, it's always the weather, maybe that prevents us from doing the work to like understand where we messed up and where we need to grow. On the flip side, if we only internalize and say like, what did I do wrong? Like, where do I need to get better, et cetera? Then we miss out on the things that were, again, outside of our control. So we take it harder and our self-esteem gets hit more than it should, which means our confidence goes and we can't perform. So I think it's really on this like balanced nuance of like, we need to acknowledge that there's a little bit of luck here. There's a little bit of external things. There's internal things that can matter. And I think it's also, there's like a sensitive window to this. Right after a loss, right after failure is going to hit us harder than if we have some time, you know, if we have a day to process it. And I think those are all the things you're juggling at to kind of make it informed, but also kind of, you know, best guess of how to handle this thing to get this person that you work with or see, or even yourself on a daily basis to be able to be okay in the long haul.
Can I say one last thing, Clay, about this topic?
You may.
We're talking a lot about like acute care or what to do when it happens. I think there's an important role for preventative care. And this comes back to something that we've addressed on this podcast many times. We've addressed this in our books, which is just the importance of having self-worth beyond your primary pursuit. And what I mean by that is if your primary pursuit is running or woodworking or writing or being a physician or being an attorney or being a great leader at your company, you want to give that your all, but you also want to have other things that you derive meaning from in your life and that you can go out and feel good about yourself in. Because that way, when you experience a loss or failure in your primary pursuit, it won't be an attack on your whole sense of self and self-worth. Hopefully, it will be a small blip, but even if it does feel like an attack on yourself and self-worth, it won't be all of it. It'll just be a part of it. So I think like upstream of the acute failure is just making sure that you got more than one thing that you can win or lose at. Now, are there times in life when you lose at everything at once? Absolutely. Like, you know, your marriage falls apart at the same time you don't get the promotion, at the same time the marathon you were training for ends due to a stress fracture. Those times are really, really, really tough. And there again, like nothing is more important than community and having people around you to hold you up. But generally speaking, things don't all fall apart at the same time. And it goes a long way to have some kind of outlets that you can use while you process the loss in your primary pursuit.
That's why more than once in coaching, you have to pull out the, you know, does your mom still love you? Does your dad still love you? Do you still have friends and family that love you? Do you still, honor student getting your degree? You pull out all the good things. And again, it's the perspective of other things in your life. And I think Brad's spot on. It's so, so important to deal with.
But I think that's a trap, is people lose that because they think that like, if they want to be the greatest, they have to sacrifice all that to be the greatest. And what they don't realize is that they're setting themselves up for like loneliness, burnout, resentment. And even if they do get on a roll and they win, I'll tell you what, like winning is pretty empty if you don't have anyone to share it with.
And you know, this is another topic, but I think it's one of the reasons that often you see college stars fail on the next level, even in sports like track, where it's the same freaking event. Nothing changes, right? There's no, I'm going to the NBA and it's different here. You're still running 100 meters. And so often they don't run as well in college. And I think part of it is because the college atmosphere for some diversifies like those meanings, those pursuits. You have other things in life to kind of balance you out. And they get told like, go all in, focus on this all the time. And sometimes it backfires, not always, but sometimes.
So that's actually a great segue to the other type of loss I want to talk about, because you're talking about someone who goes and they lose their ability to be what they once were. And this is, you know, I think this is something that we don't talk about a ton of, you know, but it's something we've all gone through to some extent. I know, Brad, you had to stop running. Steve, you're still an incredible runner, but I don't think you're throwing down 401s anymore. I haven't hit a jump shot in basketball since 2016. And so it's hard to be like, now when I play pickup, I mostly don't play pickup for that reason, but it's really hard to go out there and sort of compete against the ghost of who you once were and realize that you don't measure up. And I'm curious what you guys have learned about like leaving that sort of self behind or making that transition and learning to, you know, it's really about acceptance. But for someone who's listening and is struggling with that sort of acceptance, who's maybe realizing I might not get back to being however fast of a marathoner or 5K runner or 10K runner I was, or maybe my days of playing pickup basketball are behind me. How would you, we'll start with you, Brad, like how would you talk to them and coach them through sort of leaving that self behind and accepting the new version?
Oh man, I could go on forever about this because I've lived it in myself, and then I've lived it with a lot of people who I've tried to support through similar transitions. So the first thing that I would say is it's really hard, and there's no escaping that. I'm going to say that quickly because like there's nothing else to it. Like there's no sugarcoating it. It's hard. It sucks. The second thing that I would say is to try to ask yourself what core needs the thing was meeting. So was it a source of mastery in your life? As in you can make tangible progress in something that was very objective. Was it a source of community that you felt really supported because you had a community of practice behind you? Was it just some time that you had alone in the day to push yourself in an area that was not encroached on by other people? And generally for most people, the actual thing, whether it's running or weightlifting or pottery or yoga or gardening, is not as important as like the underlying need that it's meeting. So in my personal case, like the need was just mastery. You know, in my own athletic career, like writing is pretty objective in about 70% of the process, and then it's completely subjective. So what's objective is there's a blank page, there's no words on it, and you've got to put words on it. And then, you know, the blank page, it's like ball don't lie, blank page doesn't lie. And there's either words or not. And generally, you have a sense if it's any good, and some people you respect can tell you. Then you got to put this shit out in the world. And that is completely subjective. And, you know, the masses are the masses, and sometimes they like what you got to say, and other times they don't, and you have no control over that. What was endurance sport for me? It was objective 100% of the way. You know, whether or not something was well received by readers or the public doesn't matter when you're trying to go, you know, sub 10 in Ironman or whatever it is. So when I had to stop competing in endurance sports because of chronic exertional compartment syndrome, which is just an issue in my calf that made it impossible, I realized that like what I actually liked was like the objective mastery progress that comes from training. So I quickly found it elsewhere in strength training. And I have no doubt that at some point I'll likely like lose the mojo in strength training. And then maybe I'll find it elsewhere, and maybe it will be woodwork or photography. Like it's really not about health or even competition. It's about objective progress because it's the one place in my life that I can get it. So yeah, I would let people know that it's going to hurt. It's going to take a lot of time. And then to figure out the core need, and looking back on it, how crazy you're going to feel. So, you know, running in endurance sport was not nearly as big a part of my identity as it was of Steve's. Like I didn't do it anywhere close to an elite level, but you know, training for long course triathlon relatively to try to go fast, I was still training 25 hours a week. I mean, it was a huge part of my life. And I distinctly remember when I stopped for like a month after, I would see people running around their bikes, and I would literally like get shots of anxiety through my body. Just the sight of a runner caused me like head to toe anxiety. And I remember thinking like, I'm not that anymore. Like, what am I? I'm not that. What does that mean if I'm not going to do that anymore? And after about a month that subsided, no shit, after 3 months, I'm like, why on earth was I spending 25 hours a week training for triathlon? These people are crazy. That's all it took. 3 months from panic at the sight of a runner to these people are nuts. So I think that, you know, being patient and gaining that perspective goes a long way.
All right. I mean, I've got decades of experience of falling short of 18-year-old Steve. So after
you have the unique experience of like experiencing the first death they talk about with athletes, like when people, you know what I mean? That's an intense experience and a very singular, unique experience. So I'm curious to hear about that.
I mean, I'd echo Brad in that first, there's no way around it. It just sucks. Especially again, myself, I ran 4:01 a mile at 18 and knocked on the door a bunch of times, but never beat that time. So I have years of experience of being able to fall short and still figure out how to enjoy running. And I still enjoy running. And I think it goes through phases. And it sucked. I mean, there's no sugarcoating it. That's what I would say at first, is it sucked. And for probably years, I didn't handle it particularly well, especially while I was still competing. But what I would say, reflecting on it and looking back, is what really helped me is separating, kind of like what Brad said, is separating kind of the activity from the competition to see what it was about. So for several years, especially while I was coaching, I still trained at a really high level. Like, maybe not as high level, but probably still running 70 miles a week and could have run, you know, 4.0 low something if I wanted to. I mean, I remember my, I think it was my second year at Houston. I paced a 1500 runner, or one of our top 1500 runners, who was a really good guy, who ran, I think, 3:45 ish for 1500, which is basically, you know, 4:01, 4:02 mile pace. I paced, you know, all the way to 3/4 of a mile. So 1200 meters out of 1500 meters of the race. It felt good. I was probably in 4:02, 4:03 shape at that point, but I wasn't racing. And I chose not to race for a reason, because I wanted to like experience and remember what it was like to just kind of enjoy the running aspect of it. So for a several year stretch there, I trained at a high level, but didn't race. And what that made me realize is what I enjoyed out of the sport, which was a lot of the kind of camaraderie, a lot of the camaraderie of training together and like pushing yourself, a lot of the like feeling you get when you can either A, go on an easy run and let your mind wander and figure out your book, you know, outline and all that stuff on one end. And then also the other end of like just feeling that pain and discomfort and being like, hey, what am I going to do here? And what I came to realize after going through that for a while is that, because that was it, like whether I was in 4-minute shape or 4:30 shape didn't really matter, because the feeling is the same. The paces are different that you're running, but the feeling of running 400 meter repeats hard is the same for me as it is for you, Clay. Like, even though if we're running at different speeds. And I think I really leaned into that, where it was the feeling and experience, and what kind of feeling and experience was I trying to get off of it. And then I think, you know, as I've aged and trained less, and maybe, you know, the age has caught up a little bit, I think I lean into that feeling. And the other thing that I do is I just try to not put myself in positions where I'm going to compare like crazy. So for hard workouts, I just go out to the park and I run hard. Like, yeah, I might do some intervals or hills or whatever have you, but I don't time them regularly. Sometimes I'll go to the track and I'll run some 200s or 400s. But I don't generally time them until like maybe the last rep. I'll be like, hey, let's find out what this is, you know? And I think what that does is it gives just a little bit of distance where I'm not constantly being like, oh, normally I used to be able to run these 800 meter repeats at, you know, 206, and now I'm running them in at 220 or whatever it has you. And I think that helps a lot. And then I think the other part that is important is just kind of redefine and reframe your goal. So I still have that competitive nature in me, but I translate that to compete in terms of like, can, you know, a couple times a year, can I just go to the freaking well? And if I can still go to the well, I'm like, I'm satisfied. Like, it doesn't matter what the event or workout or whatever it is, that's what matters. And then the other thing is like, in terms of fitness, I set myself generally goals of like, what kind of fitness am I comfortable with? So my like floor, instead of looking at the ceiling. So, you know, I think I've talked about it in the podcast before, but basically my fitness progress for the last 3 or 4 years has been essentially this, is once every couple months, I go out and run a 5-minute mile. And if it feels really hard, I train a little bit harder. If it feels easy, I just keep doing the same thing I'm doing. Why? Because I know relatively, like if I can run this 5-minute mile and it's easy, probably means I'm in, I don't know, 425, 430 shape. If it's hard, it might mean I'm in like 445 shape. And I've just decided like, hey, at this point in my life, you know, being in like 430-ish shape allows me to run with the people that I want to run with who are younger, former college athletes, or hop in to some workouts with some high school kids and, you know, hang for a little bit. Or, you know, when my wife is in shape, not get dropped by her on a tempo run. So like you just reframe the goals a little bit. And I think just having that kind of like acceptance of like, hey, this is good enough fitness for now, helped me just kind of enjoy the aspects of running that I enjoy.
How difficult was it? Well, I'm assuming something here, but I assume the external validation, whether you valued it or not, felt nice of like winning races. How hard was that to let go of?
I mean, yeah, that was really hard. I mean, I would say more than the external validation, it was more of like external validation from winning races. It was more of the external validation of knowing you, of people knowing you and you being identified as the fast runner. Right. There's like just an expectation. You're like, oh, you know, Steve's fast. He's showing up to this race, so he could potentially win it. Or like Steve's going to jump into this workout and he's going to be fine. And because like he's faster than me, you, or whoever. And I think that is the part that hits the most because your identity's tied to it. And there has to be a little bit of acceptance of like, it's okay, man. Like, I don't have to be like peak fast Steve to feel okay doing this stuff. Even when I was coaching college athletes, I remember at first, like that kind of hit me when I was making that transition of like, oh crap, like I'm getting dropped hard with the top guys in the workouts. Like where the first two or three years, even with guys like Brian, like at any moment I could have dropped him if I wanted to. You know, so it's like that transition that you kind of have to make. And that is part of your identity. And that hits you a little bit. But like Brad said, I think more and more of like that comes elsewhere to a degree, you know, and like, I don't know, for whatever reason in my life, I think part of it is the athletic identity, but I've had to make those transitions a lot. So I've gotten okay with them. I mean, athletic identity to coach identity to everybody in the world being, you know, knowing me as a whistleblower. And then now as an author, and they have no idea about my coaching or whistleblowing background. So I think once you wear multiple identities, you kind of get used to being like, hey, you know what? Like, it's not a big deal because like if this author thing doesn't work out, like I've made big transitions where either for myself or other people know me as, and it's not a big deal. So it's kind of, I mean, I think that's helped a lot, being able to kind of shed and shift.
How do you guys think about the drive to compete versus just to do something for enjoyment and how that changes with age? So speaking for myself, a topic I always wrestle with, and we actually had a listener call and leave a voicemail saying, so what, Brad's going to hit a 600-pound deadlift, then what? Is he just going to stop? And I think the person gave me
Brad,
more credit
than I deserve.
There goes
$5. Can't just throw voicemails into the, now I'm $5 poorer.
The person gave me way more credit than I'm going to deserve. I think what they actually said is I seem close enough to enlightenment where I'll probably handle it well. I don't know if that's true or not. But I often wonder, like, all right, so maybe I hit a 600-pound deadlift in a 2-year TAM period from now. Maybe I don't. But would I be happier just like putting on the rucksack and taking long walks? And I really, really wrestle with this sometimes. It's like, am I addicted to progress? Because rationally, all it takes is freaking pulling up Instagram to know that a 600-pound deadlift is going to be super impressive to some part of the population and to other parts of the population. It's so far from like truly being elite. And I enjoy training, but I don't like enjoy the self-imposed pressure that sometimes I feel of like before a big workout. So would I be happier just steving it, which is like staying fit enough to be able to train with friends? And I don't really know like when to make that switch. Cause at first it was when I hit 400 pounds we know this well enough. Then it's when I hit 500. And now it's like, all right, like what, when is enough enough? And I know that we have listeners because we've interacted with them a lot, sometimes in person, virtually. And y'all are great people. And we've got people that run the whole spectrum from, I think it's nonsense to compete in your 50s. I just want to enjoy life, to phenomenal masters athletes that call into our Zooms with more medals than I could imagine behind them. And I'm just like really curious how you guys think about that dichotomy.
I think it depends entirely what competition fulfills for you. And like for some of those masters athletes, like it makes them feel alive and it makes them feel like, you know, gives them a purpose to train and do these things. And that's great if they're motivated that by that, because like if you're 50 or 60 and doing crazy stuff and running really fast, like more power to you. But at the same time, so I think it could transition us to something we've talked before, which is like being hyper-competitive, where we lose all perspective and we're the 50-year-old masters runner who's doping to try and break some masters record when you're like, dude, no one freaking cares except like you and whoever. So like, why are you cheating the system? So I think that depends. And, you know, from my perspective, I think where it kind of hit me is like, again, I competed at a high level for a really long time in track. And I always thought like, oh, if I could only do this, you know, it was always that if I did this, I'll be okay. Or I'll make it or what have you. And, you know, that was the 4-minute mile for me for a long time. If I just do this, I'll be okay. And you realize that it doesn't really matter. And in even my coaching world, I remember at first I was like, oh, if I coach someone to the world championships, then this will change. If I coach an Olympian, then this will change. I remember as a staff at U of H, we always thought like, oh, if we coach a national champion on team, like this will change. Well, I'll tell you, after we got third the first year, you know, we walked into the AD's office and Carl Lewis asked if we could all get raises. And they said, no, and you're getting a coach cut. And like, you know, I guess whatever to them, but the point is like you build it up in your head. You're like, oh, we're third in the country. Like we finally made it. We're the best program at this school. Like, you know, we're the best non-Power 5 school, you know, we're doing stuff. And like in your world, yes, absolutely. With the athletes, does it matter? Yes, absolutely. For us, did it matter? Yes. But in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't change anything. And I think that's where, to me, it's like, that's why I don't maybe compete, is because I'm just like, eh, like, I don't need it that to fulfill, but I do need, I guess, the competitor side of me is like, can I push when I need to push? Like, that's my competition. So it's still like kind of there. I don't know if that answers your question, but like, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with you trying to lift 600 pounds.
I don't think there's anything wrong. I think sometimes there's like this internal tension where there's like two parts of my identity. And one is like the more zen, seeking wisdom and just like really being at ease. And then the other part is like the athlete. And it's just like reconciling those two things and not feeling like they're disjointed. And I guess, you know, when you said that, Steve, like what purpose does it fulfill? Is it forces me to do something other than like stress about writing the perfect sentence all day? So insofar as doing that, like it's a good thing.
I also think those two identities are going to be in conflict sometimes, right? I mean, I like sometimes you're the wanting to weightlift for the zen of weightlifting is going to conflict with the person who's competitive, right? I mean, I think of like internal family systems when it comes to therapy. It's like you have different people showing up to sort of the microphone of Brad at different times. I think of this through the lens of running. I mean, running is for me is I got into running just like I just love the ability to move my body. And when I started running, I was not running very fast. I mean, it's all relative. To some people, I'm still not running very fast, but for me, I've made a lot of progress. And I've gotten pretty competitive in some ways about running, but for me, the reason I'm doing it, and there's a lot of things in my life I'm not very clear on, but running for me is very clear. And I'm doing it as like an expression of joy and like gratitude that my body can move. And so the competitive part of me that can come out is like, you need to add 10 more miles this week. But if I'm hurting, I'm like, it's not worth it for me because like I'm not going to the Olympic trials. And so in that moment, I can be like, remind yourself why you're doing this. You're doing this because you like to move your body. If you go the extra 10 miles, maybe you can shave, I don't know, 2 seconds off your half marathon time. But if you get hurt, it's going to take away the whole reason that you do this. And so I think for me, that's like just having that. Again, I go back to the Courtney DeWalter quote, like keep joy in the front seat. Just like, why are you doing this? And that makes it really clear for me. Now, it's easy for me to say this because I've been very lucky in that on my running journey, I keep getting faster. And so the minute I hit my wall, that will be telling of, okay, can I actually accept the fact that I've reached my limit as a competitor and can really continue to find joy in this and not try to chase the ghost.
So good news for you is your training age is young enough where Steve's going to tell you, you can keep getting faster for a long time if you keep running.
And you're new. So you have different events. Like everyone goes to the marathon, but like you've got, this is why most people are traditional runners. Like what do? They run the short stuff when they're young. And then as they get older and slower, they go to the long stuff so they can still feel that progress for at least a couple of years to extend it, which again is another strategy as well for other people. It's like take something within the sport. If you're a runner, go try trail running or whatever have you that is something different that gives you a challenge where you don't have to compare yourself.
So Clay's going to run 240 for the marathon. I'm going to try to deadlift 600 pounds and Steve's going to be sitting. Steve's going to be sitting there smoking a pipe, drinking an old fashioned with too much wisdom for any of this nonsense.
The growth equation curse is back, by the way. I ran a 10 miler yesterday, was aiming for sub 60 and I ran 60 flat, which is really unfortunate because my watch said 59.59.
I 59. You ran 59 high. Those idiots round up. we have plenty of chances to break the growth equation curse. For those that are listening that are somewhat new, the growth equation curse is falling just short of oftentimes arbitrary, but also meaningful markers, such as a 4 minute mile, New York Times bestselling book, 600 pound deadlift, Olympic qualification. I could go on and on and on.
What Brad's trying to say is that we are losers, so you should definitely take lessons from us on how to lose. We've done it well. We have lots of wisdom here to offer.
We are not losers. We're going to go back to where we started. We are the 5 seed that has come painstakingly close to making that run to the final 4, and we just got across the freaking threshold. I think what we need is a mega recruit. So James Clear, if you're listening, come join the growth equation.
We need that NIL money. We need to buy our
NIL money. So let's buy our way on to the bestseller list. Let's get Clay some better coaching for his running.
Yep.
And let's get me some anti-aging therapy and all will be okay.
There we go. What a place to end it. This was great. I think that I learned a lot about loss today. So I hope that listeners, I hope you did as well. And if you take anything from this episode, let it be that if you are a professional athlete and you suffer a big loss, Steve Magnus says, go to the club. You can take that one to your coach. Let him know that, you know, the best-selling author of Do Hard Things said, clubbing after a loss is a step towards a win in the future.
And try not to take yourself so seriously. I mean, like, that's what I thought you were going to say. Like, look how we ended this podcast. You know, like, we've all had, like, pretty meaningful losses. And, like, you got to be able to laugh at yourself. And you got to be able to laugh at the absurdity of it all. And then when you've been around people that have won and have gotten the thing that you haven't, and you realize that a lot of them are, like, insufferable people whose lives you wouldn't want, that's absurd, too. When you catch yourself thinking that if you just hit the number one New York Times bestseller spot, or if you just finally break 240 for the marathon, then you'll be fulfilled. Like, you got to laugh at the absurdity of that thought. So you can take the work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. And if you can laugh at yourself, I think that goes a long way.
That's good.
Go to the club, baby.
Yeah. So let's all go to the club. The next growth equation retreat is going to be at the club.
Yeah. Also, that just happens. That comes with time, right? If someone's listening right now and they just had an acute loss, like, it sucks. I appreciate that you guys said that. It's going to suck, but eventually You will laugh. Thanks to you guys for listening. To whoever sent the voicemail in about, I can't remember what it was now, but the one that Brad spoke about, you're going to get $5 on Venmo. Congratulations to you. Can't believe Brad just turning me over and dumping out my pockets. If you want to call us and leave a voicemail, these are actually really helpful. It's great to see what's on your mind so that we can address it directly in the show. And it's just nice to hear from the community out there. The number is 646-893-9503, or you can email me at clay.growtheq@gmail.com. We will be back next week with another Coach Up. If you are enjoying the show, please review it. Please subscribe if you haven't. And most importantly, send it to a friend or two who you think will enjoy this. We're just trying to spread the word, and we're proud of what we're doing, and we want to get it out there. So if you want to support us, that's the best way you can help. All right. Talk to you next week. As always, farewell.